Sunday morning.
Good morning.
My name is Mark Clark, and welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. This congregation is a theologically diverse religious community with membership to open to all who are in accordance with our principles, mission, and vision. We are a welcoming congregation committed to ensuring people of all colors, faiths, abilities, ages, sexual orientation have a home in which they can be themselves in safety. If you are a guest of a member or a visitor to the fellowship, we extend a very hearty hello and welcome. We invite you to sign our guest book, which is out in the narthex, the welcome table. And on that form, you can request a complimentary subscription to our newsletter. And please plan to hang out after the service, and we can have some coffee and lively conversation back in the Allsop room. To begin today's service, I'd like to read a short passage, and I'm wondering if anyone here can identify who said it or wrote it, actually. So the passage is, "Few of their children in the country learn English. Unless the stream of their importation could be turned, they will soon so outnumber us that all advantages we have will not be able to preserve our language, and even our government will become precarious." So would anybody like to guess who wrote that? Okay, well, you'd probably be wrong. It's not a conservative radio jock or a conservative politician. It was actually Benjamin Franklin talking about German immigrants in 1753. There's more words that he wrote, anti-immigrant, but so while our discussion today is timely, we can see that it's not new. And it's not limited to the current political climate. We're not going to discuss a historical review. We're not going to have a historical review of immigration today. We could take another whole service or another whole year to discuss that. But today we'll focus on the political, social, economic, and personal aspects of immigration, how immigration laws are enforced today, and what effect it has on all aspects of living in America. And I'm sure we will all walk away from today's service with a better understanding of this subject. Christopher, could you light the chalice for me? In lighting the chalice, I'd like to share the words of Elizabeth M. McMaster. "We light our flaming chalice to illuminate the world we seek. In the search for truth, may we be just. In the search for justice, may we be loving. And in loving, may we find peace." So I've chosen a poem today that some of you may recognize by the title, although probably not that many. And you probably won't recognize it within the first two-thirds of the poem, but once you hear the last part, you'll understand why I chose it. "Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome, her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp," cries she with silent lips. "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, the tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." Our opening hymn this morning is number 90, "From All the Fret and Fever of the Day." Please rise as you are able and join us in singing.
Thank you.
Now is the time in our service when we share those significant joys and sorrows we carry in our hearts and minds. By sharing heavy burdens, they are lightened. By sharing joys, they grow. Please wait for the microphone so that all will hear you.
Michael Littlefather, last Monday, my sister Jane, almost 90, died peacefully. Fortunately, she was able to keep all of her great wit and her wisdom and her generosity intact until the very end. I want to repeat something her granddaughter said at her memorial service on Friday. When you were with Jane, Jane was with you. Not a bad thing to have on your tombstone.
Betty Banner, it was our great joy to attend our son's installation as a called minister at Jefferson Unitarian Church in Golden, Colorado.
Marjane Moth has recently been transferred to Bramlage at Meadowlark from Via Christi, and she's doing well, but her left side is still paralyzed.
This is a joy for the whole congregation. Mark Mayfield and Carolyn are not here today, so I'll pass it on. On Friday, their daughter Clara at the Seaman Relays, a rather big regional track meet, their daughter Clara came in third in the 1 mile and won the 2 mile. So with a personal record in that 2 mile, too. So. Sure.
I will take complete, this is Molly McGoy, but I will take complete responsibility for forming and shaping Lily Colburn into the wonderful teenager she is today. Okay, I can't take hardly any responsibility at all, but we are very happy for the Colburn-Nelson family. Lily was elected student body president for Manhattan High School. She has a strong platform. She's not here today. But talk to her about her platform, and I think the most telling issue there is that when other kids found out she was running, let's just say she ran unopposed. So Lily is making us all proud.
We honor those joys and sorrows, spoken and unspoken. Now it's time for the story for all ages, but if the young'uns could hang tight for a minute, I have a few words beforehand for the whole congregation, but especially for the young'uns. So today we're talking about immigration, which is what it's called when people from other countries come to the United States to work and live. The nation is what it is today because of our history of immigration. Except for the Native Americans, every one of us is either an immigrant or we are the children, grandchildren, or great-great-great-great-grandchildren of an immigrant. For instance, I'm descended from people from England, Scotland, and Ireland, and they came here a long, 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 long time ago. Most of us are here today are like that. We are descended from people that immigrated from somewhere else a long time ago. However, there are some people here today, I think both here today, anyway, a couple of examples of our members of our congregation that were born somewhere else and immigrated here and are now U.S. citizens. Elka Lorenz, did I see Elka yet? There, sorry. and you are a U.S. citizen now, right? Yeah, okay, I thought so. I was going to check with you, and then I didn't see you. So good, it fits perfectly with what I wrote. she was born in Germany and is now a U.S. citizen. And Slavomir Dobrzanski, sorry, I got it right earlier, was born in Poland and is also now a U.S. citizen. So, yay us. There are more stories of immigration here. Well, there's a Deepak, India, and now a U.S. citizen. So, yay for us again. So, yes. There are more stories of immigration here in this room we could possibly talk about today or probably in the whole week. So, and that's what makes the United States what it is today. We call it a melting pot. All of the people come together and share everything that they bring with us from where they were born, where they originated from. So immigration obviously isn't something that's just in our past. It's going on today. And every day someone comes to the United States of hoping at having a better life. When you hear about immigration in the news these days, they're usually talking about people from one of two parts of the world. Either Mexico, Central America, maybe South America, which is, if you look at a globe, it's way down at the bottom, right below the United States, way down there. Or we're also talking about people from Syria, Libya, Iraq, and places like that. Now, that's almost clear on the other side of the globe, but people still make the trek here for a better life. They're making that trek because of crime, war, lack of jobs, or something else that's bad back home. That's what those two groups are generally traveling here for or because of. Most would probably rather stay home where it's comfortable and they understand the language and the food and everything else. But they've decided that it's too dangerous or they'll starve if they do, so they make the journey here. And today we're going to talk about people from Mexico and Central America in the book that we'll read. Because they're coming here in the largest numbers. And many come here without the permission of the government. So I'm sure you've heard the terms illegal alien or undocumented worker. Well, that's where this story is going to lead us to. Whole families are trying to get to the U.S., including kids. Even kids as young as the kids we have here this morning, even as young as the tiniest one, are making that journey. And it's a terribly difficult journey for adults. And can you imagine how difficult it is for the tiny ones? So anyway, if the kids want to come up and join me, and we will read through our book. Oops, sorry. We've got a few today. Thanks for joining us. So today we've got a book written by a name named Jairo, who lives in Mexico, one of the countries where many families are coming from. And the illustrations, which are pretty amazing, and I'll show you, are done by a man named Rafael, who lives in Colombia, which is in South America. Remember, it's way down the bottom of the globe if we're looking at the United States. Many Colombians have also traveled here to the U.S., United States. And let me set up the story just a little bit. So the little girl in the story is traveling with her father, but she doesn't know where they're going, and nobody will tell her. So to keep her mind occupied, she counts the animals by the road, the clouds in the sky, and the stars. Sometimes she sees soldiers, and sometimes they are forced to stop because her father has to earn more money before they can continue in their journey. So that's what this story is about, and it's called Two White Rabbits. When we travel, I count what I see. It appears they're traveling in a barnyard at the moment with chickens. 5 cows, 4 hens, and 1 chuco, as my dad calls them. And the chuco in this instance is the dog. One little bored donkey and 50 birds in the sky. And notice they're next to a river. It's kind of hard to see. The river's brown, not blue. And now they're on the river. And see the sign up there? You probably can't read it, sorry. But there's a sign up there. And it says Frontera, which means frontier, which means border. So they're crossing a border. But they're doing it not on the bridge above, but they're doing it in the rafts down in the river. So when we travel, I count the people who live by the train tracks. There are people, says my dad, who live by the tracks. There's quite a few. And now all those people are getting on that train. They're climbing on the boxcars and the tankers and everything. And if I get tired, I look up and count the clouds. I learn to count to 100. And there she is, laying with her papa on top of a train. Some of them have shapes, the clouds, that is. They are swans, they are trees, they are rabbits. When we travel, I also sleep, and I dream that I am moving and that I'm not stopping. So they're traveling even at night on top of the train. That's not how you normally travel on a train, is it? But we do stop because the people who are taking us don't always take us where we are going. Where are we going? I ask sometimes, but nobody answers. The dog's following along too. We wait on the side of the highway. We aren't traveling right now. And it looks like they're still somewhere, not in the United States, but somewhere south. There is a boy, I count one. There isn't any other. Papa works while we wait, just the same as usual. So now they're stopping because they need money. The boy stays with me. We count the cars that go by, the dogs that go by, but I don't think the boy knows how to count very well. I don't know why, but that's her. I show him my clouds, the one that have shapes. And he shows me his box. There are two white rabbits in it. The truck that is going to take us arrives. The boy and his grandmother look at us the way people we meet on the road look at us. Goodbye, says the boy, his grandmother too, and they give me the box. So now she's got two white rabbits. Just two. Still just two. I'm sure there'll be more later. That's the way rabbits work. But where are we going? I ask again, but they don't answer. She's asking the rabbits this time. Nobody else is going to answer. Sometimes when I'm not sleeping, I count the stars. There are thousands, like people. And I count the moon. It is alone. Sometimes I see soldiers, but I can't count them anymore. There are about 100. We are back on the road, and I have two white rabbits. Now they're running across the desert. You notice the wall there? They're where we are. It's a big wall she's looking at. That's it. Thanks. Our congregation is entirely self-governed by the democratic process. One of the privileges of our church tradition is to provide all of the financial support from among ourselves. Generosity, therefore, is one of the spiritual values we recognize as central to our personal and our institutional well-being. You are now invited to participate in the blessing of giving. thanks very much, Matthew. Amazing, as usual. And by the way, I neglected to let you know what that was, just in case you want to go buy the sheet music and practice at home. But that was by Schumann, Etude, Opus 25, number 1. So write that down. So now on to our program for today. We have 4 speakers. I'm excited that they're all here today, and each presenting their different aspects of the immigration story. And to begin, our own Michael Oldfather, who, amongst other talents that we all are aware of, is a retired economics professor. Michael will give us a brief presentation over the economist research, which is attempting to determine the costs and benefits to the country of immigration. Some elements of the story are well known, but other aspects remain somewhat unsettled. Michael.
All right, show of hands. How many of you do not have ancestors who were born outside the current boundaries of the United States? All right. How many of you were born in Kansas? Well, a little more than I thought. All right. How many of you moved to Kansas for your job and or your spouse's job? Welcome, carpetbaggers. While some of our ancestors immigrated because of religious or political persecution, the evidence suggests that most of them left their home countries because of a powerful desire to improve their standard of living and to provide for themselves and their families. All of my ancestors, born elsewhere, arrived before the Civil War. A few of them got here before the Revolutionary War. Some of them were actually fairly prosperous and did emigrate in order to practice their religion because they'd been unable to impose it upon their neighbors. They were neither Unitarians nor Universalists. Before the passage of the Immigration Act of 1921, there were hardly any statutory impediments to immigration. Today, our complex laws differentiate among 3 types of immigrants: legal, illegal, and refugees. While the economic experiences of the 3 groups have some unique characteristics, time constraints dictate that I gloss over them for the most part. Here are some findings of immigration research where there is substantial agreement, as well as a few where the jury is still out. 1. There is considerable evidence that immigrants initially earn less than natives with comparable education, but the gap narrows gradually, and for most of them, it largely disappears after 10 to 15 years. 2. Conditions in the receiving country are a powerful determinant of immigration. Case in point, since the financial crisis of 2007, legal and illegal immigration have both fallen in the United States significantly. 3. Second. No, that says second. It's not. It's third. I edited, didn't I? All right. 3. Our immigrants are more likely to be male than female, and they tend to be younger than native workers upon arrival and most are not married and have no children. Some are better educated than their U.S. counterparts, and some are not, which complicates our story a bit. In recent years, immigrants have accounted for roughly 1/3 of the annual U.S. population growth and an even larger share of the labor force growth. 4. About half of all undocumented residents came here legally and stayed after their visas expired. Of course, the other half entered illegally. 5. Assessing the fiscal impact of immigration is complicated because some workers do pay income taxes and or make the employee's contribution to Social Security, for some do neither. However, all pay sales taxes and property taxes, the latter usually indirectly via their landlord. The total taxes paid by low-income immigrants are probably not much different from what low-income citizens pay.
Whether immigrants receive significantly more services than their direct and indirect taxes would cover is an unsettled issue. Highly respected scholars are not in agreement. Here are three perhaps relevant considerations. One, since undocumented immigrants do not qualify for many social services, their direct and indirect contribution to government revenue may well exceed their demands on it. Once immigrants marry, they tend to have more children than natives. In several communities, some not far from here, half or more of kindergartners come from homes where English is spoken little or not at all. Educating them is surely somewhat more costly than providing schooling for the children of non-immigrants. There is ample evidence that immigrants incur lower public safety costs than natives because they are more law-abiding than natives. They do not want to be deported. Perhaps some of you saw an article an op-ed article in the Kansas City Star a couple of weeks ago. It's titled, "For Our Safety, Welcome Immigrants," and it's by the retired chief of police in Garden City. And it tells the story that one hears over and over from law enforcement people, and that is that immigrants are good citizens. Immigrants are perfectly willing to cooperate with the authorities, or at least they were until January 20th. And the cooperation has decidedly gone down. This morning's New York Times had this headline for an article, Too Scared to Repeat Sexual Abuse. Because of deportation. And I editorialized that, ironically, this situation protects the bad hombres. It's inappropriate, six, to say that that immigrants take jobs that natives don't want. It's more nearly accurate to say that many immigrants are willing to work for lower wages than many native workers. This results in lower wages for some native workers and unemployment for others. Four relevant points here. Supervisors whose skills are complementary to those of low-paid workers benefit, as do business owners who hire the cheaper immigrants. In addition, many consumers benefit to the extent that lower wages translate into lower prices of the immigrant-produced goods and services they buy. Three, past efforts to find U.S. citizens to do field work and other jobs tending and harvesting fruits and vegetables have had little success, even when the wage rates are radically higher than immigrant farm workers typically earn. Finally, immigrant workers are often victims of labor market discrimination. Discrimination invariably costs societies because the favored workers are less productive than those discriminated against whenever ethnicity, gender, sexual preference, or any other criterion for hiring replaces talent, experience, skills, etc., as a basis for selecting workers. Seven, I suspect that many people will promote fairly high immigration quotas because our aging population will need an increase in workers to support Social Security and Medicare payments for them. Welcoming immigrants because our ancestors were given opportunities to make a new life has a lot better feel to it. Besides, the new immigrants will get old someday. Where will they find someone to pay for their old age? Bars? Well, we need an approach which reflects the motives of our better angels. A note on research in this field. One of the most highly respected scholars who publish research highlighting the costs of immigration is George Borges. No, I messed that up. George Borges, who was Jorge Borges when he came to Florida from Cuba as a child. I always thought it was an odd person to be largely opposed to immigration. There's a greater chance that one can find several articles by equally well-regarded economists who dispute his results. The Center for Immigration Studies is another matter. At least they are upfront about their commitment to producing research that points out the cost of immigration. They raise millions of dollars every year from opponents of immigration to support their nefarious efforts. Read them with caution, because it's mostly nonsense, high-paid nonsense. Finally, a little casual empiricism. Go to most any hotel, restaurant, packing plant, or construction site and try to imagine how the economy would function without work done by immigrants. We need to promote policies and programs which support moving our often underutilized and exploited immigrant neighbors, friends, co-workers, and relatives to move them out of the shadows and into full participation in the country's economic and political life.
Thanks very much, Michael. Next, we have Slavomir Dobrozhansky. Is that better? Initially an international student, then a non-immigrant temporary alien worker, a permanent resident, and finally a U.S. citizen. Slavomir will talk about his own experience with the immigration system and how each of these stages in his life came with its own unique set of problems and challenges. Slavomir.
Well, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Well, I was, you know, when I was preparing the speech here, I had an issue whether to make it a personal confession or an informational session, and I was sort of aim at something in between, and I was assuming that Michael will provide lots of statistics here, so I'm not good at numbers, so there won't be any statistics in my speech. One thing, I will not be talking about undocumented immigrants. I'll be not talking about stories of people who settled in the United States through marriage. I will not be talking about people who entered illegally or lost their legal status, but I will be talking about people who fall into the 74 categories in which I was as a person living in the United States. First, I was a student. Then I was a non-immigrant alien worker. And then I became a permanent resident. And then I became a citizen. And each of these categories is connected with volumes of legal details. And so that makes the life of these people extremely complicated, sometimes very, very complicated. The students that come to the United States, they are already selected very carefully, both at home. They are the best students that the country has to offer. Also scrutinized for their financial means to be here, and yet they being a student is also the status of international student is politicized very often. You know, we are educating enemies of America. They will be spies, and we're letting terrorists in. There was some of it about in 2001 in the political discourse in the United States. These people are under tremendous pressure to succeed from their families, and many don't realize that when they leave, they are actually expected to settle in the United States by their families. Actually, returning to your country is a proof that you have failed, and many don't know that, okay? They also realize that in their home countries, very often you get a good job through connections rather than through qualifications. That happens. When they come here to do their PhD for 4 or 5 or sometimes 7 years, suddenly they become simply overqualified to return to their country. The country where they come from does not own a technology that matches their qualifications. They cannot do research at that level in their home country, and they don't know that when they come here. So In certain way, the longer I stay here, a certain process of alienation from the home country begins, especially when there are political changes in the home country. When I came here in 92, Poland was just entering the market economy. And so when my subsequent visits to Poland, I couldn't recognize my own country. And, you know, the democratic institutions were introduced and so on. So basically, within 10 years, I felt like a foreigner in my own country. What is very strange is the way the American government is set up. After 2 years of being here, foreign students become residents for tax purposes. And that confuses them greatly because on many forums they are considered U.S. person. And, you know, and however, at the same time, the law says that pretending to be an American citizen is a great, you know, offense, and, you know, it's against the law. So there's a certain confusion that begins when you live here for a while. Sometimes, as a student, many countries have a treaty with the United States, so the students pay the taxes in the U.S., sometimes they double taxed, you know, it depends on the situation. Students are sometimes victims of racial discrimination by faculty, and they don't have a representation. So this is one of, and you know, I know that case state, but I was a witness to racial discrimination, and the person, you know, there's a pressure from home, you have to succeed, there's a pressure to keep your, to be here, you know, and succeed. So they don't report anything. So that's a problem. One thing that students are not prepared for from foreign countries is how to manage their money, because they're absolutely not ready for the strength and volatility of the American capitalist system. You show up on campus and someone tells you New York Times, $1 a month, and after that you will be billed 52 in 3 easy installments. And, you know, and the person is very convincing, so you sign up and very soon you are in debt. You know, so that they absolutely not prepared for the many ways in which money can be extracted from them, whatever very little they have. So that's a danger. Many students come here, and of course, being very young, they meet their future spouses, very often from another country. Okay, and so let's say a person from Poland met a person from India in the United States, and they both were not, you know, legal residents at the time, and in their respective countries, their relationship is not recognized in any way. So that's a problem too. And many students, not all of them, later when they get a job, they become H-1B workers, and the visa is up for up to 6 years. After that, you have to leave, I think, for 2 years, and then you can return again. Once the job more or less appears to be permanent, the offer, you can apply for permanent residence. It seems like, you know, the people make decent salaries and so on, and they should be able to, at that time, participate in the American dream a little bit. However, there's lots of pressure from home, you know, and these people very often feed large families in their countries. And so there's also an issue of the H-1B spouses who have no right to work. You know, so people sit at home and basically get depressed. And so there's one person that works full time, and the other person is supposed to just be there and do nothing. So that leads to depression and marital issues. One thing that happened with the H-1B visa, this is another very political status of an alien in the United States, was that there are so many people from that category waiting for green cards. And there's a delay by several decades at this point for Indian and Chinese citizens. And there's two lobbies at this point in the country. One, I mean, at least used to be, because at this point there's basically, if you're an immigrant, you're a bad guy. But used to be that the pressures from one side to legalize, to offer permanent residence to thousands of Chinese and Indian citizens was somehow in conflict with legalizing all the people who arrived here not in a legal way, from Mexico or Central America. And so between these two parties, no agreement could be made, so we are where we were before. My personal story about getting a green card, I have to give credit to someone who actually rescued me personally as a human being. I received a notice from the Immigration Service that an additional medical procedure was needed immediately. They gave me 2 weeks to do that. There was one doctor here that was authorized by the government to perform the procedure or the test, actually, test. However, to get an appointment with him, you had to wait 6 months. So the letter says you have basically 10 days. The doctor, you call them, they tell you, well, it's January, we can have you in November 23rd. How about that? So the thing, basically, it seemed like, well, it's not going to work. So I mentioned it to a faculty colleague, who she's not living anymore. It was Dr. Jean Sloop. She taught at K-State for like 47 years, and she called them, and she told them, you are destroying a life, and that helped. And she got me in, and so here I am, still talking to you today. So these kind of little issues can mean your life turns dramatically this way or that way. And then after being here for 12 years, you receive a letter that says, welcome to the United States. And you are very confused because, you've been here for over a decade. Suddenly you're welcome to the United States. Okay, fine. Of course, there are some things that the permanent residents are still subject to. For example, double taxation. Your country wants taxes from your salary from here, for example. In case there is no treaty between these two countries, that still happens. If you inherit something in your home country, and say you liquidate the apartment or whatever in your home country, your home country will take taxes and the United States will take taxes and no one cares. You cannot make them to meet. You cannot make, there is no one on your side. So there are some issues here. Many children of permanent residents are not aware that a small infringement or small drug offense can mean you're deported. And they don't even know what happened. Their friend, had to do social work for 2 weeks, but they're deported. So this is a big problem. So after a while, you realize you keep paying taxes and you still have no rights. So, and as the country was in what seemed to be an idealistic phase, we decided to apply for citizenship, and we went back to filling out all these forms. And, one of these requirements is to report all your travel since you became a permanent resident, and we travel a lot. And the language is extremely vague. And, it calls for a lawyer immediately. Whatever you touch, it calls for a lawyer. Let's say you traveled for 1 day to Canada. You left on May 1st. You came back on May 3rd. Were you gone for 3 days or were you gone for 1 day? So the entire system is, so you start researching and then you will discover that some lawyers say you were gone for 3 days. Some lawyers say you were gone for 1 day. At my citizenship interview, he had to ask me, have you traveled between, filing the application and our interview? Of course, I have traveled, so we had to add all these days. And he had counted the days the other way than I counted my days, so when I was applying. So it means that there are some things that they themselves don't know. One thing that was a worry for me was, for example, I contribute financially to all kinds of causes such as protection of animals or National Park Foundation or gay rights or, and suddenly you're supposed to list what have you, all the organizations you have contributed funds to, and suddenly you realize some of them might be political. Is protecting national parks a political organization? Possibly. So you start panicking. What have I done? I might have destroyed my life, and so on. So this is very stressful. Everything is, of course, under oath. So I served in the Polish military for about 2 weeks. I was a part of a communist army. I had no idea. So I had to explain that and so on. So this was also very stressful. So my final conclusion is that we have to resist the fear that is planted in our minds, basically on a daily basis, the fear of other people. I think that today the immigrants are blamed for not being successful and for being successful. Whichever way you go, you're basically a bad guy. You're not welcome here. So, and it absolutely frightens me when I hear that people are rounded up on the main television channels. I don't know what century is this, but this is just absolutely frightening. A situation that I haven't seen in this country, and I've been here since 1992. So we should not blame people for wanting to improve their lives. It's just absolutely wrong. And however complicated the issue is, it can be dealt with. If there is a goodwill, there is a way out of the situation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was eye-opening for sure. We have another half of our presentations to go, but before we do, maybe we can stretch our legs and our vocal cords a bit and rise as you were able and help us sing hymn number 127, Can I See Another's Woe? So as a quick introduction, we've got the technical things figured out. This is Marie Beauvais, more correctly. And she is the Federal Programs Coordinator for Training and Development for USD 383 and has a responsibility for monitoring and supporting immigrant children and their families as they confront a variety of challenges here. Marie will discuss the responsibility schools have for the safety and security of our children, what that means for our schools, and how it affects our community.
Good morning. I want to give you a little bit of background about myself. I was actually born in South America. I came here at the age of 3, and I primarily was raised here, but I consider myself still South American. I went through school here. This was what I consider home. So when we arrived here, it was in the 1960s. And just a little synapse of what we experienced, because this is not about me, but when we got here, it was in the 1960s. So what do we do with the brown folks? Because we're already putting the black folks in the back of the bus. The white folks go in the front of the bus. What do we do with the brown folks? So we experienced a lot of racism. Buses would purposely avoid us or not see us. So we would be waiting at the bus stop and buses would avoid us, splash us with water. We would have doctor's appointments catching the bus and couldn't get there because the bus missed us accidentally. So anyway, these are just simple things that memories that you look at in there, even though just one little incident, it affects you. And here I am many years later, 100 years later, and I'm still thinking about those incidences in my life. So wanted to share with you what we're doing as a school district. I know we have laws that affect us and are behind us, but also affect our families in different ways. I'm sorry to give you my back. But the main reason I did these slides is so I wouldn't forget everything I wanted to share with you guys. Okay, so primarily my role is to follow the executive order that was implemented in January 25th of this year. But using the safety net that we provide safety and security for our children, we also have other laws that help us guide our families and help us with our families. And one of the things I share is this is not to sway anybody on any political side. In being in the school system, it's very hard because a lot of people are swayed in different sides. We are trying just primarily to take care of our children. Okay, so we're talking about a raid. What does a raid? So everybody talks about raids. We don't really understand what a raid is. A raid is exactly when they come in and they just take a person. They have to have a warrant, but they don't always have a warrant. They shouldn't be in the schools, but they can be around the schools. So they go around a lot of different ways on how they pick up our families. I had a family member who they had gotten out of church. They were going to the little market, which they called a bodega, which was kitty corner from the church. And the little girl was saying to her daddy, "I want an ice cream cone. I want an ice cream cone." And as her daddy turned around to see what kind of ice cream cone she wanted, when he turned back around, ice was right on him. And they immediately took him, which was the saddest thing, right in front of his children. So this is what families go through when they are picked up. And it's a very hard situation. It's horrific for the child on a daily basis when they leave the home. Just the idea of leaving the church becomes even a sad situation for the children. Okay, I do ask for help. Help me, please. Right there. So, like I said, they're not supposed to be near the school, in the schools, but with a search warrant, they can. If a person they're supposedly going to pick up is a threat, they are allowed to be in the schools. So theoretically, they're not supposed to be in the schools. Right there. Thank you. Okay, so these are conversations, now that this is going on in our communities, conversations we have in our communities is, once parents are picked up and you're handcuffed, what do we do with our children? Who takes custody of that child if both parents are picked up? Okay, so you envision this. You just, as a mother, immigrant mother, and you've just been picked up. Supposedly your husband's been picked up or both of you have been picked up. What happens to those children at the end of the day? They're expecting to come home and see mom and dad. And this is what we've had to deal with. In Western Kansas, we have 300 individuals that have been picked up already. So I'm not saying how many families that affects, but you can just imagine that. Just one person being picked up, it really takes a lot on the family. What procedures are we going to take? Okay, so now my next-door neighbor got picked up. Their parents got picked up. Now I'm a child. I'm a student in the high school. Do I really want to go to school? So that's another avenue that we have to think about is the truancy levels that the schools experience. And so, but we have rights, okay? And there's laws that help govern what we can do as a school. And primarily these laws help ensure that our children are not being discriminated because of their status in this country. So as a school, we use these laws to help us keep compliant and go forth in helping our students. One of the things schools have done previously is that they've denied access to immigrants. Oh, you don't have a social security card. Oops. So that now is against the law. We are not allowed to ask children for a copy of their social security card. Yes, immunization records. We can't discriminate or ask a child, come back. It's November. Come back in January, which I have actually seen. Oh, jeez. So, being an administrator at the high school or at the schools, you are in a very big bind because you have to be compliant with the law, but yet we have to provide security for our children, and that is a very fine line to cross. We do have, though, and this is a very important law that people don't really take into consideration. As a school, if our children are going home and we know that area has been raided and mom and dad are gone, it is our responsibility to make sure that child is not left alone. So as a community, as a school district, it is our right, it's the law that we are to take care of those children. And this was, I was sharing this, my slides were actually 40 minutes long, so I made it really short for you guys, but I was sharing this previously with another community, and I had somebody come up to me and said, well, aren't you infringing on the law when you're helping these families? And we're not. We're providing safety and security for our children. And so that was brought up to me, and it just hurt my stomach because when we're helping these children, I'm sorry, they're our children, and you can't say that we're infringing upon the law. So that was one of the things that I wanted to make clear is we're not harboring, we are just providing safety and security for our children. So when a parent is picked up, that child is considered homeless. As soon as a child does not have an adult or guardian to take care of that child is considered homeless. So we have the McKinney Homeless Act that really supports our efforts in the school system. So that's why a lot of schools are That was my timer. Okay, so we got together and as a community, and we have working together as a community, and this is why I'm here, is a lot of these churches have gotten together. I'm sure some of you are there, have gone to our meetings, and as a community, we're going to work towards helping these families, even though these families are very closed. I'm not going to lie. I wouldn't trust anybody if I was undocumented either. Very closed, but we're going to provide a group of people that will serve as surrogate parents. During this interim of where the parent, when, between the child goes to where the parent wants the child to go to. So let's say, my child was taken, I was taken away, okay? So I'm away at a detention center. Where is my child going to be? So what we're encouraging families through the legal system is to provide a power of attorney. That child goes to my uncle in Nebraska. But meanwhile, there's days where that child needs to be somewhere. And so we're asking that our community serve as surrogate parents and provide a home for a few days, temporary home for these children. These families will go through a background check, and they will go through training so they are able to support a child who's going through such a traumatic time in their lives. I put this up, too, because we had a meeting with the police department, and there have been incidences that, you know, where people have been deported because the police department. Well, our police department have already said that they are not going to be ICE. They're there to make sure that our people are safe and they're doing the right thing, but they're not going to be there. But also now with the new laws that have been implemented by our president, they also have to support whatever he mandates. So as of now, our police department are not ICE agents. And they shared this with their all their staff. So the director put this out. So we're working, when this comes, if this happens to come here, because it's already happened in Western Kansas to 300 individuals. If it comes here, there's two people that were picked up in Topeka, supposedly because they had broken the law. But if this happens here, we need to be prepared, even if it's three families or 40 families. We need to be prepared towards what we're going to do with these children. And these are children from Head Start, kindergarten, all the way to 12th grade. And so when your life is just taken away from you all of a sudden, you need support, and that's why we're working as a community to try and see if we can help these families. So, like I said, this isn't just to sway one way or another. This is primarily to provide safety and security for our children, and I hope I've given you some answers. And thank you very much. Thank you for listening.
Whatever you can in the time allowed. All right, do you want a microphone, or are you going to come up here and you want me to do the slides for you? Okay. 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 So next we'll have Christopher Renner, who's been very active in local political scene for many years now. And he's going to share the what the UUA initiative is and give us more information on that. So. Just a second.
Since I only have 5 minutes and this is about a 20-minute presentation, if you go to the UUA website, uua.org, UUA is working on a national policy on immigration and providing sanctuary. And one of the things that it's asking people to do, both as an individual and as a congregation, is to sign on to this Declaration of Consciousness. Those of you who saw the film that was on PBS last fall about the two UU ministers who worked in getting Jews out of Czechoslovakia, this comes from that tradition. And so you can go to the UUA website, you can sign the declaration. One of the action points for our community is, are we going to decide to do this as a congregation? Which is a very important, I think, discussion we need to be having. The concept of sanctuary is quite old. It goes back to Greek times when temples were given sanctuary to people trying to escape political persecution. Today in Kansas, there are only 3 counties that have decided to take up a sanctuary position. That's Harvey, Sedgwick, and Butler County. In all 3 of those counties, it's official that the police department will not work with ICE and will do so only under a judge's order. Even though our local police force has said they won't, there's no official statement and there's no official documentation to that. And so that's one of the things that we need to be thinking about. We should probably also be thinking about how to take this beyond us, which is part of what I was going to talk about. The UUA talks about 3 parts. The first is deciding what you're going to do as a local group and an individual. And then you have to start looking within yourself to grow solidarity. So within this congregation, we would need to do some studying. We'd have to set some time together where we would come together as a congregation. We would do some study, some reflection, and some reading. There were 2 videos on the UUA website which have suddenly disappeared. But I suppose if you dig somewhere, you'll find them. And one of the things they were talking about in particular, for example, First Unitarian in Denver actually has people living in their church right now. They are an active sanctuary, and they have people living in their church. One is a mother of 3 U.S. citizens who ICE will arrest the minute she leaves the church and deport to Mexico. She's married to an American. But she, like many people, are not regular with their papers. And ICE came to her home. She went out the back door and went to the First Unitarian in Denver, and she's been there for almost 3 months. There's other UU churches that have done that as well. So we have to decide how far we're willing to go as a congregation. We have to reflect spiritually on what that means for us. We have to do some decision-making processes of our own and how we're going to do this. The next step then is to advancing sanctuary in the broader community, which is what 383 has been talking about here. We need to look at partners like First Congregational, First Christian, First Methodist, all of which have position papers already in place on this kind of stuff. The Manhattan Alliance for Peace and Justice, the Mennonite Church, the League of Women Voters, all these kind of organizations come together and have a common front on what sanctuary will mean in our community. Once we do that, then we move to public statements. And the public statement not only is that we are a congregation of conscience and we oppose what the Trump administration is trying to do by scapegoating an entire group of people and promoting xenophobia as a result, but we also then start making local statements. I do know, because I work in the ESL community, that even people on base are afraid of ICE visits. Many of our active military service personnel are married to people who are not from this country, and not all of them have their papers in the condition that should be.
For example, in the school I teach at, there are four families whose mothers are not regular with their papers, and they could be deported at any time. So it's a huge issue. I encourage you to go to the UUA website. The actual program is... The program is called Love Resists. There's various pages, all sorts of stuff to download. There's a 7-page PDF for your own personal reflection to look through as well. Because it's a very, taking on sanctuary positions, it can be a demanding thing because basically what the Trump administration is doing is they are turning the ICE people into brown shirts. And so if we decide to take a stand for our immigrant community, that will open all of us up as well to being targets of ICE. So we have to think through what that means on a personal level. I know some of us are already probably on some lists in Washington, D.C., but as a community, then we would be on that list as well. We would be publicly decried by certain elements as opposing the glorious vision that Trump has to make America great. So anyway, my time's already up and I've gone over 2 minutes, so thanks.
Given the time, I'm gonna suggest that anybody who wants to leave,
of ours who have already sung this song, we'll sing it and you can join in with us or go on to your next destination. Well, we'll give you about a minute for us to get set up and then you can there you go.
Come on up, singers.
While Michael's getting set up and the singers are on their way up, I'd definitely like to thank the four presenters today. We are months on this. The fact that we had a limited time is not great. But anyway, I'd ask everyone today to be part of the solution to the challenges that are faced by all the immigrants and the strain that's put on our social network and economy and our schools. So you're up.
The words are in your in an insert there, and Somos el barco, we are the boat, somos el mar, we are the sea, yo navego en ti, you sail in me, or I sail in you, and then tú navegas in me, you sail in me, and you'll catch on, I think. The stream sings it to the river sings it to the sea. The sea sings it to the boat that carries you and me. Somos el barco, somos el mar. Yo navego en ti, tú navegas en mí. We are the boat, we are the sea. I sail in you, you sail in me. Now the boat we are sailing was built by many hands, and the sea we are sailing on, it touches many lands. Somos el barco, somos el mar. Yo navego en ti, tú navegas en mí. We are the boat, we are the sea, we are sailing you, you sailing me. Oh, the voyage has been long and hard, and yet we're sailing still, with a song to help us pull together, if we only will. Somos el barco, somos el mar. Yo navego en ti, tú navegas en mí.
feet. We are the boat. We are the sea. I sail in you. You sail in me. So with our hopes we raise the sails and face the wind once more. And with our hearts we chart the waters never sailed before. So sail our boat. So sail our. Yo navego in ti. Tu navegas in me. We are the boat. We are the sea. I sail in you. You sail in me. I sail in you.
Bon voyage.